Life After Capitalism. The phrase catapults the imagination into visions of what a good society might look like. It's also the title of Michael Albert's new book, where he proposes a participatory economy. Noam Chomsky says Michael's work merits close attention, debate, and action. Michael Albert is founder of Z Magazine and ZNet. I spoke with Michael about Paracon. It occurred to me that if anti-capitalists want to change one economy for another, a good place to start would be to ask, what's an economy? Here's Michael's reply.
Well, any society has to produce stuff. People consume it to live and also to prosper and fulfill themselves. It has to be allocated. The items that we use, the inputs, the outputs, they have to be determined in how much, where it goes, how much people get, and so on. So these functions, production, consumption, allocation, they're what an economy does for society, so to speak. And it would be good if an economy did that in ways that fulfill values that we hold dear and rather than trampling values that we hold dear.
And what kind of values are there in a paracon?
Well, the values that make sense to me are, you know, we have to be pretty succinct here. So regarding relations among people, I think solidarity is a desirable value. People should be concerned about one another's well-being, should benefit mutually, rather than people existing in a rat race where even the winners are rats, rather than having institutions that pit us against one another and that make nice guys finish last. Another value would be regarding the range of options. I think diversity is a positive value rather than commercial homogenization, which limits the range of available ways that we can experience life and express ourselves. A third area of concern is decision-making. How much influence should we have over decisions? I mean, we could spend some time on this, but for myself, what makes sense is that each of us should impact the decisions that affect us, should have an influence over the decisions that affect us in proportion to the degree we're affected. I call it self-management. It's not one person, one vote. It's not consensus. It's not any other single approach. It varies in different situations. Sometimes it makes sense for you and you alone to make a decision, what you should wear in the morning, you know, whether you should have a picture of the person you live with on your desk at work. Other times it makes sense for larger groups of people and sometimes huge groups of people to be involved in a decision and to have different amounts of input. So self-management. And finally, equity. How should the fruits of our labors, how should the product of society be distributed among people? Should it go to people by virtue of the power that they can wield, the bargaining power, sort of the philosophy of Genghis Khan and the Harvard Business School, for that matter? Should it go to people by virtue of the fact that they own property, that they have a deed, a piece of paper in their pocket? Should Bill Gates be worth more than the population of, I don't know, Norway, because he has a piece of paper in his pocket? I don't think so. I think what we should do is reward people for the effort that they expend and for the sacrifices that they make and the work that they do. You put these values together and you ask the economy to produce what people need in order to fulfill themselves and to develop themselves and to fulfill these values, to enlarge solidarity, diversity, equity, and self-management, and you have a kind of an agenda, I guess you could call it, for thinking about an economy. Does it do those things or not? Our economy doesn't do those things. I'd rather have an economy which does.
So if we take those values and we mesh them into a workplace, a Paracon workplace, how does this translate into workplaces? How are workplaces organized?
What do we know now? The workplace that we know now is Well, for one thing, it's a dictatorship. That is to say, most people in the workplace have virtually no say. A few people have all the say. It's actually worse than a dictatorship. There's no dictator in history, not Stalin, not anyone, ever conceived of creating a system in which they would have to be asked if people were going to go to the bathroom, for example. And yet in typical corporations, you often have to ask permission to do that if you're in the lowest rungs of the institution. What we have in these institutions is a very harsh and severe division of labor, and as a result, division of power and of income. If we're going to have a workplace which produces solidarity instead of antisociality, which gives people self-management, then we have to have a workplace in which people, by virtue of what they do there, are prepared to participate in decisions, have a degree of confidence, a degree of social skills, a degree of understanding of what's going on, and so on. And so one of the institutional features of participatory economics is what's called balanced job complexes, that the division of labor should be changed so that we all have a balanced array of responsibilities which gives us comparable empowerment in our daily work to what others enjoy. Also, there should be institutions in the workplace of decision-making that aren't, you know, a few people in a corporate boardroom, but rather what are called workers' councils, groups of workers, the appropriate group for the decision in question, wielding influence in proportion to the degree that they're affected. It's a very different kind of a picture. But in order to accomplish that inside of a workplace, you also have to deal with the way workplaces are connected to one another, the allocation system.
Just backing up just a bit, you mentioned earlier payment for effort and sacrifice, and I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that and how workers would be reimbursed for their labor in Pericon.
Well, as it is now, the rhetoric is that we get remunerated for our contribution to the social product. The reality, of course, is somewhat different. In reality, what we get is what we can take. In a market system, you're paid what your bargaining power enables you to demand. So that's what I meant by the ethics of Genghis Khan of the Harvard Business School. But that other option, the one that rhetorically is supposed to hold, that we get what we produce, that we get what we put in, sounds good on the face of it, but it really isn't. What it says is that if you're physically bigger and stronger, and you're doing some kind of physical labor, you deserve to be paid more than somebody who was born weaker and smaller. Just by virtue of that difference, that physical difference over which you had no say whatsoever. It says that if you have better tools, you should get paid more. It says that if you happen to be producing something that's more valued, you should get paid more. I don't think any of those choices make sense. It seems to me that what makes sense is that we should be remunerated for the effort that we expend. In other words, how hard we work, how long we work, how intensely we work, and for the onerousness of the work we do. So, if I work in horrible conditions, if I did, in a prior econ this wouldn't be the case, but if I work in our society in a coal mine, let's say, for a 40-hour week or a 50-hour week, and somebody else works a 40 or a 50-hour week in much more pleasant and less debilitating, less physically draining conditions in an air-conditioned office, spending time on the phone and talking to other folks and so on, it's the former person, not the latter person, who deserves to be remunerated more, who deserves to be paid more in order to elicit such activity, activity that's so debilitating. Now, in a para-econ, what we do is we have balanced job complexes, so we don't have some people doing horribly onerous work and other people doing highly pleasant work. We have everybody doing fair work with a fair proportion of those characteristics, and we remunerate for effort and sacrifice.
So many have claimed that there is no third way to markets or central planning, and Tina, that there is no alternative. How does Pericon situate itself between these and attempting to allocate goods throughout society?
Well, I want to answer that question in two parts. I'll do the second first, which is the more important in some sense. Participatory economics proposes something called participatory planning. It's very hard to do any of this so succinctly, you know, in this kind of a context, but participatory planning is a different way of doing economic allocation. Instead of doing it from the top down via something called central planning, which actually not only was the system that existed, say, in the Soviet Union, but is also the system that exists in a considerable portion of our economy, for example, in huge corporations in terms of their internal decision-making. But also, it rejects what's called markets, market competition, which is a mechanism by which people pit themselves against one another and seek the best that they can get for themselves, but in which the social whole suffers as a result. It's a system that has many drawbacks. It improperly values products. So, for instance, it overlooks ecological effects, collective social effects, paying attention only to impact on buyer and seller. It would be a long discussion to go through all the problems. I'm what you might call a market abolitionist. At any rate, participatory economics proposes something called participatory planning, which is a cooperative, collective, negotiated approach to allocation, which apportions appropriate influence to all the actors who are affected by economic decisions, which doesn't have a center or top, but does have a reasoned calculation, if you will, a reasoned assessment of society's options and a choice among them, with fair apportionment of influence over that choice. But as to Tina, if somebody says to me there is no alternative and is crying when they say it, okay, I can respect them. I think they're wrong, you know, and we can discuss their reasons for believing it and my reasons for proposing an alternative. But at least, you know, one can respect that perhaps they've come to the conclusion based on a sober assessment, and because they're crying about it, that they actually understand the implication. There is no alternative means a large proportion of humanity has to be starving. A large proportion of humanity lives under bridges or in alleys. People suffer bombs and wars. It means there's indignity. It means there's alienation. It means all those things are permanent. It's like somebody saying a long time ago, Tina, about slavery, or Tina, about the fact that women couldn't vote and participate in social life, or Tina, about feudalism, or Tina, about the pharaohs. How does anybody know this? How does anybody know that nothing more is possible? Well, if they're crying, maybe they think they know it based on thinking about it. But if they're gleeful, which is the typical attitude that comes forth when somebody says Tina, like Margaret Thatcher, who invented the phrase, then what you know is that they're saying it not out of an honest belief, but merely to trample and to deny hope, to make people relent in any thought that anything else is possible. It's a very effective strategy. Cynicism, despair about alternatives is a very significant bulwark, I suppose you could say, leg upon which oppression rests. And so strengthening that leg by screaming over and over again, Tina, is effective, but it's a lie. And what Parikon is all about is, in a reasoned fashion, with hints, with description, trying to create a case that there really is an alternative and what it could look like and why it would be desirable.
So in this third way, this system of participatory planning, to make it concrete, there must be some process of information distribution so that people as consumers or producers can make informed proposals. How does this happen?
You're absolutely right. That is to say, if you want to have allocation and you want to have self-management, then you have to have a mechanism or a set of procedures which allow consumers and producers to assess their actions sensibly. We have to be able to make judgments about what it is that we want to consume or how much we want to produce in light of the implications of that for other people in the society. So it's very important that the allocation system conveys that information qualitatively and also in terms of exchange value, that it lets us know the relative worths of things, taking into account true social costs and benefits, all the social costs and benefits. So it doesn't do any good, for example, if you have markets and the price of gasoline is registered as $1 a gallon, but because it pays no attention to ecological and social effects, it's off by a factor of 15, and it should be $15 a gallon. That's not helpful. It isn't efficient. That is to say, it misprices and it misallocates if what we're concerned about is human well-being and development. It's very efficient if what we're concerned about is the profits of oil companies. For that, it's very efficient and effective. Going back to participatory economics, the mechanisms of participatory planning which if I try to describe them in any detail in, you know, 5 minutes, is going to not be compelling, not because it's so complex, because it isn't, but just because it takes some time to get the texture. But the mechanisms of it are basically workers' and consumers' councils, that is to say, groups of workers and consumers organized in workplaces and in neighborhoods and in larger geographic units, proposing what it is that they want to produce or consume. And a mechanism then exists for that information to be circulated in a kind of a horizontal way among the actors, and for the actors to assess the information and in light of it to make new proposals in which they change their choices in light of the current assessment of relative valuations and benefits and costs throughout society. And what happens is each actor is sort of deciding overall how much work do I want to do in my balanced job complex, how much do I want to consume, given the relative costs and benefits of things, given how much of my total budget I have to expend. And you an initiation that goes on through a number of rounds, you move toward what's called a plan. Any society has it. That is to say, a determination of inputs and outputs throughout the economy, and then you begin to act on it. The details are what's spelled out in the book, among other features of participatory economics. What I hope listeners will think to themselves is, gee, I hope he's right. Obviously, you know, this short of a presentation, nobody should think, oh, that's wonderful, I'm all for it. That wouldn't make any sense at all. But I think what does make sense is for people to sort of think, gee, it would be wonderful if it was possible, if it was in fact relatively straightforward, to define structures for doing work, for allocating, for consuming, for making these decisions that were consistent with these values and that could accomplish fulfillment and development for the population efficiently. People should feel like that would be wonderful. This sort of sounds relatively sane and sensible. I should look and see whether or not I think it's viable. And if I do, good, maybe I can become an advocate. If I don't, well, then maybe I can tackle the problem myself, because we certainly need an alternative to capitalism.
And today, one of the movements on the forefront to challenging capitalism is the anti-corporate globalization movement. They've challenged the World Bank, IMF, and WTO. How do these institutions you've outlined in Paracon, how do they translate, or how do you see them relating to this movement?
Well, first off, corporate globalization is really just sort of acting on the world stage to change the rules of the game of world exchange to benefit the rich and powerful even more than they already do. And the movements against corporate globalization, so in other words, the IMF, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, they intervene in international relations on behalf of the rich and powerful. The anti-corporate globalization movement is saying basically, wait a minute, we're not against international interactivity, we're not against exchange, we're not against cultural flows and so on, we're all for that. But we're for internationalism rather than corporate globalization. We're for reorganizing the rules of international exchange so that the benefits accrue more to the weak and the poor, so that the gaps of income and power that exist in the world are diminished rather than enlarged. Okay, I'm for that too. Obviously, Paracon is for that also. A problem that arises is that the average person says to the corporate globalization movement, what are you for? And they don't only mean, what are you for instead of the IMF? They also mean, I think, what are you for instead of capitalism? Because they know that the IMF, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization, corporate globalization more generally, are products of the dynamics of domestic economies. If capitalism persists in the United States, South Africa, Australia, India, England, and so on and so forth, and we win via our anti-corporate globalization movement, changes in international trade, we replace the IMF, we replace the World Trade Organization, and so on, those domestic economies will continue to emanate pressures, if you will, that will push against the gains that we made internationally. those domestic economies will seek to reimpose themselves. So, what the person is asking is, why should I think that you're asking me to do anything other than roll rocks uphill, hills, and then get crushed by them when they roll back down on me? Why should I believe that the gains that you're seeking, ending the IMF, etc., stopping war, whatever, won't dissipate as capitalism reasserts its authority in very short order? And so the person is asking, and this is what Margaret Thatcher understood, the person is asking, what's the alternative to that underlying system which produces all these ill effects? I'm happy to fight against the IMF, the World Bank, war, poverty, and so on, if I can feel that in my efforts to fight against those things, I'm not only fighting against the symptoms, but I'm fighting against the underlying causes. And so eventually my efforts lead to a steady, trajectory of changes, and then change the basic causes. So I think that the connection between Pari-Econ and the movement against corporate globalization, or for internationalism, is that Pari-Econ provides some insights into strategic questions about what we should be seeking and how we should be organizing, but mostly that it provides an answer to the question, what's the alternative? What do you want? An answer that goes deeper than just we don't want the IMF. It explains what we don't want the current U.S. economy either.